Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Blowing up Greg Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew back on the board. S&P futures up 7. NASDAQ futures up 99. We're trying to go for 3 days in a row. Is the 7 that people absolutely foolishly sold last week is flying back up again. You can't sell those guys. I mean, we've got NVIDIA up this morning, another 17. Tesla, which made 45 cents. We got two spots here. Earnings per share, 45 cents adjusted, whatever that means. Then another 34 cents a share, kind of regular. It's not so hot for a stock. It's up $18, 163. So even if you use the 40-cent number, talking $1.60, so that's, 100 times earnings? 120 times earnings for a company that's been around that long? It's a car company? I mean, whatever. I guess the idea is they're going to launch a lower-priced car late next year. Kevin, you going to buy one?
Nope.
You're not on the waiting list?
Nope, don't want one. Next question.
Why don't you want one? What if I gave you one? You'd kick it back to me?
Pardon?
If I gave you one, you'd kick it back to me like a bad fish?
Oh, no, you want to give me one? That's fine. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that.
Well, then you got to go put the.
And I'll hold you to it.
Well, then you got to put the, what do you call it, in your garage, right? Charging station.
Actually, I probably have what I need to do charging from my days of owning the mobile pet grooming business. And I had the right level of service put in there. I just have to get the right kind of connector.
So you got 220, whatever it takes, from the movie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
220, 120, whatever it takes?
And RV outlets outside. So, yeah, if you got an RV, you can plug in at my house.
Cool. God. Well, so that stuff's up. We've got, we got a lot of earnings this week. We have Telephone's earnings are this morning. I've got Telephone up 55 cents, so we'll see where that goes. But there's been a few around. UPS was yesterday. It came in okay. I mean, these earnings, but the thing of it is, there's not near as many people, I don't think, Kevin, that are actually all over these earnings, and the companies don't give a lot of stuff out, so all about is expectations, but they should really tell you what they're doing over a 4 or 5 year period more than you can find it if you dig, but it's not there in front of your face as much. We have the market really seems a lot relieved this week. Then we were down next week, so some of it's a bounce back, some of it's a bite of dip, but some of it, I think the market's a little bit relieved about the Middle East stuff, at least not accelerating so much over the weekend. I'm not the, like Lou and Mike know this international stuff as much as those guys do, but I was pretty surprised at the limited scope, of the Israeli response, because I'm not a huge fan of Netanyahu, but what do you make of all these demonstrations? They're all over the place. I mean, I'm getting worried about the summer here with this convention. If there's not a ceasefire in Gaza by then, I mean, it's going to be pretty ugly here, I think.
Well, Tom, first of all, let me put it this way. I'm wondering who's funding all of this kind of stuff, because there's a lot of equipment that goes in there, camping equipment, high-end stuff that the typical students aren't necessarily going to they're not likely to afford themselves. So somebody is funding them, which means somebody is really trying to upset the apple cart here. I don't know who. I don't know if it's an outside country like China, or if it's a, oh my goodness, if it's, you know, it could be activist organizations. There's a lot of opportunities, and I'm sure we will learn something about this. But as part of that, do you think if they're trying to stir the pot, that they're just trying to stir it on behalf of Hamas? Because the students are dumb. When they put cameras in front of them, start asking them questions, they're just going on, well, oppressor oppressed. And that's, you know, that's the conversation. And they, you know, no deeper than that. When you, if they start getting asked more about the situation, they don't know a damn thing. So who's doing this and who benefits from it? Now, I don't know the answer to that yet, but I think that will unfold. And as we think about that, what that really means is that that this isn't going to go away just because things die down in Palestine, in Gaza.
Well, I mean, and you're the one who's always talking about how when people jump to the next subject. I mean, if all of a sudden things sort of quiet down at all, I mean, it's not like Ukraine has quieted down. You know, it's not like all these places really have quieted down. I mean, Afghanistan never quieted down, really, if you were over there, but people got bored with it here. I mean, if there's a ceasefire and some sort of United Nations rebuild of any kind, even if it's half-assed, it will be enough to get people on to the next topic, unfortunately. I'm not saying they should stay on it and keep demonstrating. I'm saying
so now where do the protesters go? I mean, that's it. That's what I'm saying is there. You know, there was in the last election. There is now. There is this mood that wants to do a lot of protesting. Well, do you think they can't find a next topic to get onto?
Well, I mean, I just wonder, Kevin, and I know that. I'm way too far to this side of the I won't say the aisle, but maybe I just did. Not left or right, but the idea that at the end of the day, an awful lot of protests are economic. I mean, Vietnam was somewhat different because you could find yourself in a jungle the next day shooting at somebody before they shot you. Well, that wasn't really economic. You know, that was kind of your skin. So it was a little different, but. I think this whole idea that the unrest there is, really, from just about anybody, the mega people are showing their unrest kind of that way by backing somebody who, you know, say is an outsider, is different. They're showing their disgust with what's going on that way. They don't like the way the government is fighting back by putting the guy up in front of 15 different courts. Which, by the way, I find pretty repulsive as well. Everybody's figured out that if you don't play the game, somebody's coming after you. That the Justice Department on both sides has been whatever. I mean, you saw it here with going after even Blagojevich, who was a knucklehead, but he still didn't deserve 14 days. It's all over the place, and it's economic. I mean. Not only is everybody we know scraping, well, to a certain extent, or not scraping, but they're not proceeding. Even people that have a comfortable living are not as comfortable as they were 2 years ago because of the inflation and because of the other stuff. Anybody who had money in the bank lost value. I mean, come on, you did. And yet, all day long, all you do is listen to people telling you how good everything is. For them, or it appears. So this wedge between parts of the population just keep getting driven every day. And some young people, we had a Joel's replacement, Aaron, on a couple weeks ago. He's a, you know, nice guy and really kind of knew his stuff, and I'd like to debate more with him. But if you believe all these numbers, you got a whole different view of the world than if you look at people. I mean, all you have to do is look at the healthcare industry and you see how people are getting being eviscerated, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And, so, I mean, it spurts out. It's not like... I'm not going to put this, don't sound like a total idiot. It's not like if you're pissed off at your wife or kid, that's always the person you yell at, right? You know, a lot of times there's what are Blade called? We call it displaced aggression or something. I mean, you think people in traffic that blow through a stop sign and flip somebody off, think they're really mad at the guy next to them, or they're mad about something else?
Well, they're just angry in general,
yeah.
And it comes out at every turn.
Yeah.
But I don't know that when I say someone's funding it, what would you do? Say you were the Chinese, and you really want to advance your standing on the world in the world pecking order relative to the United States. What would be a way to do that? Well, one way to do it would be to have all kinds of unrest in the United States, and to just fan those flames nonstop. Because remember, you get protesters who are really a fairly small subset of society, but they're a very loud one that gets a lot of coverage and gives an impression that that things are awful. So, as you start to look at that, and I'm just being hypothetical here. I'm not saying I know that the Chinese are funding this, because I don't know that. But I'm saying, if you really want to undermine the United States, same thing we would do if we want to undermine the Chinese is really, get a popular uprising, get a vocal uprising that makes their government look bad in their country. Well, you know what? It's been going on a long time. The Chinese play a lot of long game. They may have, they could very well have gotten to this point, and they're good at it. They're really good at this kind of stuff. So they attack it on a lot of different fronts. So what I'm just saying is we really need to follow the money on these protests.
Well,
they're very loud, they're very vocal, but really, where is it coming from? Because I don't think that the amount that we're seeing is organic college student uprising. I just don't think it is.
Well, Kevin, I think it somehow ties in with the woke movement. We had a meeting last week for Judge Tooman's 86th birthday. He's deceased, but some of his friends got together, and one of the guys, this attorney, and he said his daughter accused him of being a white somebody who took advantage of everybody else and took everybody else's money. A white. This whole routine that, even though these people have grown up in a place where there's some subset of freedom, maybe not as much as you and I would like, but there's more than just about anywhere else, and something we still hold dear and fight for, that have had the best of the education, have never gone a day without a meal. Now all of a sudden they've become, self-flagellants of what have we done to the rest of the world? What do we do to, the poor Indians? And we talk about slavery, which was a horrendous thing, and why it was ever allowed in the Constitution, obviously money. It should never have happened. We understand that. But we also forget the part that the people who sold the people into slavery were black. And we also forget the part that an awful lot of people from the North lost limbs and lives freeing slaves, that they never had one, they never made a dime for one, and never did anything. So we don't give those people any sort of truck whatsoever. I mean, we're going to try and give we're going to have people going crazy over we have to give restitution to people that maybe weren't even descendants of slaves, but we're not going to give a dime to a family that lost a grandfather in a civil war. I mean, the 19th century pretty much sucked for everybody. I mean, but we're going to pick and choose the people that we're going to, and again, nobody even was repulsed by the idea of slavery more than me, and how we managed to let it go on here. But I also know that the idea of getting rid of it was a massive sacrifice by a lot of people that didn't have any part of it. So, I mean, there's blame and there's good things that happen on both sides, but this idea that somehow, the Indians should still be here, I don't think these people would have liked to live in a Comanche place, would they? I don't know. I mean, stuff just happened, Kevin. It's not like we can go back and redo it. It's just, what you can do is sit there and go, all right, now we got the rest of the world to worry about. let's make sure that as much as we can, people don't do that to people ever again. And yet, we're worried about that. I mean, does anybody really know? I mean, I was involved, not personally, but I was in high school when the 67 war took place. And one of the brothers at Marist brought in a guy who was a Palestinian. And he said that his family, the first boarders that were there, now who knows? He seemed like a guy who wasn't lying to us. When the first boarders were there, that his family was told to move three times because the Israelis just kind of expanded the borders on their own. And finally there was a big war, and then they won, and they took more, and people were back. And, the guy said, it's a lot of it. This is 67, for God's sake, Kevin. He said, what is the difference between an Israeli commando and an Arab terrorist? They're same thing, aren't they? Just fighting on different sides. Well, that was when,
I get that. I've heard that. The idea that Israel would just kept expanding its borders is nonsense. That every time they expanded their borders, it's because they were attacked and they won.
Well, according to this guy, they were expanded when he was a kid, when they first got there in 48. There was always debates. Who knows? I don't think I was right, wrong, or in the barrel. But there's no doubt that when you have a problem and there's a war and you get attacked, and Lou and Mike would say, well, if you got attacked and you win, well, guess what? That's yours. And you know what? There's some truth to that, but I also know you can't have three generations living in camps in the Baca Valley and not expect trouble. So I'm trying to be all over this issue, because in order to solve it, you got to understand all sides, I think, if there is such a thing as a solution, if you're going to make progress. And like you said, by the way, very brilliantly, I think, a lot of the demonstrators are just, this is the thing to do today. Now I started the ones at Columbia, it's all about, they don't want the school investing in any company that does business with Israel. Really? I mean, really? But then again, if their dad owns stock in the company, it goes down to zero and it's their stock, they're probably not going to be happy. So, everybody's got water, Duke Jeppin used to say, everybody's got water on both shoulders on this deal, right?
Yeah, I think in that case, too, if you ask them, which companies are you talking about, do you think you'd get an answer?
Oh, no. Plus,
once you're to divest of all companies that do business or supply weapons to Israel, okay, which ones are those? Which ones in the portfolio are those? The answer is going to be don't know.
Well, it's also, out of all the, as we start demanding perfection from other people, as you know me forever, I'm not exactly a biblical scholar, but one of the lines I absolutely remember was, anybody without sin can cast the first stone. And this whole idea that Israel is this horrible, horrible place. Again, I'm not a fan of the leader, but okay. I'm not a fan of a lot of leaders here either. There are only real ally over there of any kind. And they have been a staunch ally, partially because they need us, but partially because, we helped them. There was a United Nations resolution that they got that land, right, wrong, or whatever. As I used to tell one of the guys who was an investor in the firm, why didn't you grab Utah, for God's sake? It's a hell of a lot nicer and less trouble. I know it's a sad joke because there's no religion part there, but I'm saying, what are we? There's this huge history to it. I mean, do we really want to throw Israel to the weeds and decide that Iran is our ally, or Syria, or even Saudi? The only reason why we're an ally over there is because of oil. I mean, they're the ones that paid 17 people on a plane and knocked off the World Trade Center, right? If you trace the money, you trace it there. But we don't want to do that. We can't do that because those guys give us oil. Do you think the people... who's going to be our ally in the Middle East if we decide we're going to let the Israelis go under? I mean, really? I mean, you're right. Nobody's thought any of this through, Kevin.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the people who haven't thought it through, apparently, who don't appear to have thought it through, just so happened to be, running their foreign policy.
Well, I mean, I think we can't, as bad as the, some of the characters are, I don't think we can let Israel go under. I don't think we can let Ukraine go under as bad as that. Because what does that do to encourage people? I mean, do you want, the last thing you want, is other than maybe, where do you think the long-term story is in the Syria, Lebanon? If it wasn't for the guy who's somehow keeping Jordan together, what would the Middle East look like, for God's sake? I mean, what is Iraq? I don't even know what their government is. Look how much we lost interest in there. Does anybody even know what the government looks like there? And is it any good? Maybe Mike does, but I mean, what a mess.
Well, what's interesting is that the countries who had made bilateral agreements with Israel a few years ago have kind of held, you know, stayed out of things in this recent conflict, which means those treaties are kind of holding. What was interesting about the approach in making those various agreements is every one of them cut the Palestinians out. It just didn't even consider them. Because, you know, the common belief is that if you're never going to have peace in the Middle East unless you solve the Palestinian problem, which in part means have a separate Palestinian state. Well, you know, maybe that'll happen one day, maybe it won't, but if you just go start picking off the various Arab countries one at a time and waging peace, you know, which is as good a term as I can think of for any, that, you know, you're going to get enough critical mass where you will start solving other problems.
Well, I agree. The Palestinian issue, you can't just, somewhere along the line, and again, I drop back to this economic stuff, I don't care, well, I don't know, hopefully we'll land there. I'm not sure if you're in heaven and 40% of the males 18 to 35 are unemployed, you're not going to have a problem. Or not have nothing to do all day. I mean, it's just...
I understand. So, but the question answer is, why are that many people unemployed?
Well, I'm saying you can give Palestinian, somebody can allow the Palestinians to essentially exist in Gaza. Okay, is there a railroad? Is there a business? Are there crops? Is there a port? If you got none of that stuff, what does that even mean, exist in Gaza?
Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff. And
they got no port? We got to make a port.
There's a lot of people who on a daily basis were crossing into Israel to work.
I'm saying they didn't do any. That they did. I'm saying that they, not that they didn't do anything, but there's unrest. I mean, there's unrest. Why would people, you know, vote for? I mean, one of the things I think.
The question, Tom, is whose job was it to create that, to deploy the resources they have in a way that benefits the people versus deploying the resources that they have in a way that attacks Israel? Because you had a Palestinian Authority, and they chose the latter on there.
Okay, but I understand.
And
I understand that.
So that's not Israel's fault.
All right. If for instance the Canadians did something stupid and invaded, all right, and we kicked their ass, and all of a sudden instead of living in Toronto and all the other places they used to live, they're sitting somewhere out in the middle of nowhere for 30 years. It wouldn't surprise me at all that they elected a bunch of idiots that whose only thing they knew in life was hating the U.S. I mean, I know it's a weird, but you can't just let the thing fester. And if you're close to it, guess what? It's your problem. Look at our issues with Mexico versus Ireland and immigration. If you're close to it, it's yours, unfortunately. I mean, we can't say I was talking to somebody yesterday that they found there's a case in Illinois. They just picked up 60 kilos of cocaine, Kevin. 60 kilos, for God's sake. Now, did that come from Mexico? Did it come from a cocaine lab in the mountains of the West Coast? I don't know. I mean, it's right next to you. You know, it's almost like if you live in a really nice neighborhood and there's one really horrible block where people are shooting guns in you. If it's near you, somehow you own it. You don't want to, but you do. I mean, am I right? I mean, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're trying to say specifically.
I'm saying is you're right. Should it be a guys that happen to be all Israeli problem? The answer is no. Should the Baca Valley or the West Bank be all Israeli problem? No, it's kind of a world problem. I mean, should the gazillion refugees from Syria that piled into Jordan, if ever there's a guy that should win the Peace Prize, should be the guy that runs Jordan, should that be all Jordan's problem? No. But is anybody helping out? No. I mean, they just happen to be the person because they happen to be next door. And why are we having all these Mexican, you know, the problems, people pouring over the border? Because we have a border. You don't see Canada with the same problem. They don't have a border. I mean, somehow or another, you know, proximity, I guess if it's your neighbor next door that's starving, I guess I'd feel more of a inclination to help them out than if they were halfway across the country. I don't know, Kevin. It just seems like if you're close, you're involved somehow, doesn't it?
Well, but it seems to me that if I'm close and you're launching rockets at me, that's a different kind of involvement.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're not going to get me to be an apologist for Hamas, but it doesn't surprise me that the people there voted for them. So I don't know what that means.
Keep in mind, you got the Egyptians right next door. They don't want any part
of it. That's what I'm saying.
See what's happening.
Well, that's my point. You can't have the Israelis and the Egyptians with these guys in the middle just saying, well, we'll ignore them for another 20 years. It ain't going to happen that way.
Well, they aren't in the middle, and
they're right between them.
They do have... They're kind of on the edge, I guess you could call that the middle, but they're also bounded by the Mediterranean. So you asked about a port. Could they have a thriving port on the Mediterranean? Yeah, they could.
Well, they don't.
Ports. Yeah, well, they're too busy building, you know, with weapons and building tunnels throughout the whole area, under hospitals, under schools, under every place like that, and you know, places where Hamas can hide out and where they can launch where they can get rockets in and out and stored and weapons and all kinds of things. So yeah,
Kevin, I'm not
sorry.
I'm making myself totally
I what you're saying, but you know, at some point, whether it's your neighborhood and somebody's doing that, I mean, what are you going to do if somebody on your block is has a weapons cache or something like that? You're going to help them, or you're going to try and do something about it?
What makes you think somebody by black does it? How do I even know?
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
Well, I guess I'm trying to, I'm doing a pretty poor job of it. You know, I'll admit that. I'm trying to draw the line between when you put people, or people are stuck in a certain whatever it is, mindset, economic issue, whatever it is, you can sort of predict what's going to happen. Right? It doesn't mean you caused it to happen, right? But you can sort of predict it. I mean, I think part of the maybe one of the reasons it has me feeling like this, Kevin, is I read two books about the U.S. during the Depression. One wasn't a book really about the Depression. It was the biography of Armin Hammer, and how his father was a doctor. And by the way, he was a medical doctor too, but he went to one birth. It was a breach. He managed to save the kid and said, I'm never doing that again. So he really practiced for like one day. But the old man went to a couple of socialist rallies in New York. And he went to do a... and they were keeping track. Now, during the 30s, the people our age, younger, especially the young people wandering through, you know, all these demonstrations and stuff, you gave them a test, they have no concept that during the Depression, there were very serious concerns about, was our government the right way to have a government? I mean, it wasn't doing so hot. You know, and people were asking the question, is a socialist system better? Is a communist system better? You know, they were asking the question because, guess what? We sucked at the time. Our economy was absolutely in a hole. We didn't recognize during the 20s how top-heavy we'd become when the thing crashed. And those people lost the dough, and nobody had any money left to help out. And we didn't... It was an absolute fiasco. So Armin Hammond's father went to one of these things. And by the way, I dug up a picture last week. I thought I sent it around, of some massive Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden in like 1933 or 1934. They didn't call them Nazis. There was a U.S. name for the Nazi Party that I forgot, unfortunately. So, I mean, the idea that we came within, you know, real close of having the same kind of problems here, because we're not immune. You can't take 80% of the population and say, all of a sudden, you know, you're in a bread line, you're doing this, you don't have a job, or 70 or whatever it was. What was our unemployment rate at the top, 40%? Something like that? We were going through the same stuff here until all of a sudden things got a little bit better And the war started. Or we actually, the war didn't start. We started putting companies back together and building war stuff for Britain and France probably in 1937-38. That's what started us to getting out of the mess. Okay, and we did it kind of on borrowed money, all right, just like other people are doing. We were not immune to this, Kevin. I won't say we lucked out because how many people died in the war, my uncle included. But, I mean, we got out of this. Everybody forgets all about that. The same kind of crap was happening here with the same results. People were getting pissed off. Fortunately, our country's so damn big, and there was no transportation. It was pretty hard for a guy pissed off on a farm in Iowa to get to Washington to do something about it. I mean, it was different in that regard. But it was the same thing. Unemployed people, you know, people desperate. What are they going to do? They're going to ask, you know. Am I wrong or not? I mean,
I think you're right, because I think to a certain degree that's what's going on now.
Oh, yeah.
In the U.S. It is not all about unemployment, because anybody who wants a job can get a job. It may not be a good job. It may be a part-time job. It may be, when you're talking about a generation that we told all had to go to college, that was the way to go, and now they're finding out that you know, that the wonderful career jobs that they went to school to earn are not the kinds of jobs that they are really able to get in quantity right now, and unfortunately we forgot to tell people that it takes time to work your way up. That was probably a slight omission that we shouldn't have made.
There is
an expectation here. That's what I'm saying. There's an expectation that's not being met, and that makes it real easy to enlist people to causes in very, very unproductive ways.
Well, and it also, I mean, why should somebody who has a high ability to create value for somebody, which really is what labor laws or labor economics is all about. I mean, why should, you know, if you and I went to work for Walmart, I have to believe, and we went into the, you know, because I know something about cars. If you and I went in the tire area, I'm going to say within 3 months, that tire area is going to do twice the business they're doing now. Now, why should we be making a minimum wage and not get paid for it?
Well, you should, but don't use minimum wage as the example, because hardly...
I mean a base wage. I mean, if we're worth, you know, 100 grand a month to Walmart, why should we be making 15 bucks an hour?
You wouldn't be for long.
Well, maybe. In their mind, we'd be there forever.
Well, I don't think so. That's not my experience in corporations. When you have people who make you a lot of money, you tend to find ways to keep them, incentives to keep them.
Do you think anybody in the Walmart tire departments anywhere gets paid on everything they sell? I'm thinking no.
Do you think there's commission salespeople around?
Not there, I don't think.
Really good at selling tires, you can't go find
maybe, well, maybe like the it. Maybe the Just Tires down
find
the block.
Do that someplace else? I think you're not.
I think that that kind of mobility through the society, because of the amount of places that have, taken over other places. I mean, do you think with that thing loosening around in the last 20 years, how many people in the defense industry have been taken over by 3 or 4 or 5 firms? Do you think your mobility there is as easy as it was 20 years ago? I'm saying no. I mean, mobility is really tough. Matter of fact, I wanted your opinion on before we get Lou tomorrow. I don't know, is this an executive order or what was it? But somebody came out and said they're going to ban these non-compete agreements. I wonder if that flies, but if it does, what's your opinion on that? People have non-competes for everybody now, it seems, in some of these places.
Yeah, I think a lot of non-competes are not enforceable as they're given to people. It may not be enforceable, but as long as the person who signed it thinks it's enforceable, it's enforced.
Well, and if you got to hire an attorney at $500 an hour to prove it isn't, nobody can do that.
I don't think I have to pay $500 to get an attorney to do that. The point is, you can't tell people they can't work. That's not an option. Now, you can sort of restrict the way it does, But usually when you get a non-compete, you also have a substantial payment in exchange for that. So that becomes part of the equation. And look, I once had a non-compete thrown at me in the language of an employment contract, and I just read it and said, no, I'm not doing that. And basically it was when I was in Milwaukee, and I can't remember exactly how it was worded now, but it was essentially said, I can't work in banking if I quit. And I said, look, if you don't want me to compete in Milwaukee County or something like that, then fine. I'll look into that. But if you're telling me I can't work in the industry, or I can't work in the Midwest, or I can't, you know, that's not going to fly. And I remember sitting down with the HR director and the president to go over my concerns with the contract, because that wasn't the only one. And he looked at the HR director and said, "Does mine say that too?" And she said, "Yep." And because obviously he didn't read his contract, and he said, "Oh, we got to fix that."
So. Well, I'm going to say that in what's left of my industry, when I say what's left of it, in terms of a lot of people putting markets to the trading floor, you know, like when I was on the floor, there's probably, I don't know, I'm sure there's a few more outliers someplace, but let's say there's 10 firms. And Kevin, you've met a lot of these people, by the way. A couple times you've come by for a beer. And every single one of them, I will bet you, has a non-compete. Well, this is your skill set. This is your industry. And some of them are like a year. And these are people that work in the back office that do, like, risk management. I mean, I could see a month where you forget the positions the other people that you have, because the positions change by the day. I could see you doing that for a month, but some of them are like a year, and when they hire.
So, Tom, it becomes what's a reasonable thing to ask, and I don't think it's in general it's not reasonable to ask people not to work. On the other hand, you can say you might say you may not contact and solicit any of the customers in your portfolio for a year or something like that, and. And given the new person taking over those customers, a chance to make good with them. But on the other hand, could you stop those customers from contacting me and saying, no, I want to go where you're going? And the answer is, you would never be able to prevent that. So, you know, why bother trying?
A lot of people.
Kevin, it's really common. It's common in places like, you know, any place where somebody is going to have a following. So it would be common, for example, for a chef in a restaurant saying, sorry, you can't go someplace else in the city while you're under contract with me. The expiration of the contract, you cannot, you can go anywhere you want, but if you decide that you want to walk away from the contract, sorry, you're not going to my competitor while you're under contract.
There's people in this industry, Kevin, that have actually sat out 6 months with the new firm paying them. Because they all have them, and they all respect the other guys, which is even crazier.
Yeah, well, but, you know, that's because the new firm has an anticipation that they're going to get a lot of business out of it, and it's worth it. You know, so I think anything that is mutually agreeable is fine, I suppose. It's when the company says you want to get paid, or you want to get a severance, or you want to, you know, whatever. When that happens, that's where you start to get problems. Because it's basically you're forcing somebody to take an agreement.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's
not 100% forced, but you're not giving them good options.
But we don't. I mean, at PTI, one of our strongest advantages, and a disadvantage. Every advantage is a disadvantage. We have people that deal with clients. We never were a commission type. If the firm did well, people got bonuses. It wasn't like if you could, if your client did a trade, you got paid for it, like a commission on the trade. We never did that because we just never liked that. So we never did that. But if we were to hire somebody, and he had 15 family members or some kind of crap or whatever that came with him or whatever that were his clientele, and he brought them over here, if we were ever to do that, it's pretty hard. if we can, the guy to say you can't take those people with you because you're the ones who brought them here. They're your people. They're not really ours. They're yours.
Well, no, they are yours, though.
Well, yeah.
They're yours because you were paying the salary when they were brought in.
Well, and I'm talking about some people who bring them from another place where they came from. And it's saying this gets very complicated. I'm not arguing. I'm just saying it gets very complicated. But anyway, Kevin, the theme kind of the... We got to talk a little bit about sports. So the theme kind of the week has been you start to see all this stuff that I see as like imbalances. And Carl's always talking about the imbalance in how much people are charging on the Medicare side. Not the Medicare, the medical side. And how people can't afford it. Insurances are going, are having real problems with it. Companies are gagging on the insurance payments, as is the federal government. Yet somehow or another, these companies are powerful enough that they can continue to get paid $1,000 for stuff that's worth $20. And it doesn't just... People say, well, how does that affect me? I'm not sick. I don't give a crap. Well, the funny part was, I know somebody last week who had an apartment for rent. And there were all kinds of people who wanted the apartment. And guess who the people who got the apartment... Because now, from what I understand, and I just heard this from a few people... And Audrey doesn't like doing rentals all that much, but so it's not like this is coming from her. But it's not unusual now for people to want three times the salary as the rent. And this is on the application form from the person. It's not if your apartment's $2,000 now, it's not unusual to say I want a 690 credit score and I want paychecks of three times that amount for the last 3 years. You can do that. And guess what? People are applying. And the funny part is, this one person was telling me, was one group, how do they get to the top of the list? They said, well, like, we'll pay $2,100. And the owner said, okay, well, we'll take that. Well, it turns out, evidently, the people at the top of the chain, one was in the medical device industry and one works for a hospital. So it's not like it doesn't affect you, because the $1,000 you just paid... for a fatso drug at Northwestern that cost them $4, or an MRI 6, that all of a sudden they're not turning around and outbidding you for the car or the apartment you want. I think if there's a message to the show, Kevin, is you always got to follow through on this. Where does it go? How does it affect you? I might be one of the guys that just paid for the MRI, and now I'm getting outbid for the apartment for the guy I just gave the money to. I mean, it all comes together, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and so... every time somebody intervenes in a market, it gets out of whack. Whether it's the government doing it, whether it's patent protection, all kinds of things that are affecting these that are non-economic that we think we're doing for good smart reasons.
I'm getting more cynical. We're not doing it for good smart reasons. We're doing it because those people have the power. They know they're crooks, and oh, by the way, they have the power to get them. Do you think the people at Commonwealth Edison really think they're doing the world a favor when they charge you that kind of money for a line into your house that's been there for 100 years? Do you really think they're that altruistic?
No, I think, I always tell people that very often doing the right thing is also smart business. In their case, no, it's not. I'm not that naive, Tom. What I am saying, though, is that's what we're telling everybody.
Yeah, hey, I don't know if you want to dash right away, but John's coming on. I was kind of hoping to get a couple people involved. The things you were sending out about what is happening with some of these smaller universities, and what is the long term ramifications of it? Is it less places for people to go? I mean, I got the memo from Eric a while back and saying that Columbia is in trouble. Then I saw a couple of headlines in Crane, Chicago, and somehow they had a big drop in enrollment during COVID, which I guess a lot of people have. And you sent me some stuff yesterday about different schools. And obviously, John's involved. I don't know if you can spend another 10 minutes or not. But
yeah, I can do 10.
I'd like to go over that. I mean, what are the ramifications? Because we're talking about, it's sort of the same thing in a different way. Well, economically, it's the same way as the hospitals. You have schools charging... incredible amount of money, where if you look at what Eric's making, or somebody else, or even somebody at Notre Dame or Northwestern, and you look at the 25 people in class, and how much the they get paid vis-a-vis the tuition, and you sit there and go, how the hell did this overhead get to be like 1,000% or something? And it's a problem. I mean, in my opinion, economically, it's a big issue. You have every advantage in the world. I mean, there's no taxes. You get this, that, I mean, whatever. So I just want to see where is this going to, is it ever going to affect the Harvards of the world? Is it ever going to affect, and who is it affecting? And if the schools that it is affecting, is it affecting the people we care about? I mean, if St. Xavier went under, I'd say that's a big problem for the South Side. You know, I look at how many people have gone there for, I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out, maybe with but it's the same sort of thing, though, John. It's a industry that got sort of very bloated. A lot of it had to do with people were able to get borrowed money. If there never was any borrowed money, tuition wouldn't be the way it is. I mean, I don't, you know, does Notre Dame really need 80 grand a year? I mean, for God's sake. You know, what did our friend Bob used to...
Well, all those buildings they're putting up aren't going to pay for themselves, Tom.
Well, but I mean, most of them are sports facilities. Does anybody care? I mean, you and I do because we love sports, but really?
Although, I would say no, that they, I would not say most of them are sports facilities. They're building like crazy all over the place.
Okay.
They're basically monopolizing the local construction industry. Anybody else who has a project needs to go out of the area to get labor.
Really? Wow. S&P futures up 13. NASDAQ futures up 119. We'll see if we do 3 days in a row here. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Low and open stocks and jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 11. NASDAQ futures up 112. Strong. Tesla is up 12.5%. Is they're going to lay off a bunch of people and say they're coming out with a cheaper car at the end of next year. And everybody's all over that one. NVIDIA's up 14. We've got Meta up 13. These are the guys that got hammered last week. They're all coming flying right back here. We'll see. Looks like now it's going to hold. Interest rates are... We'll do all that stuff at the half hour. John, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We're
good morning, John.
We asked Kevin to hang in a little bit here because we're talking some about these college costs and the overhead and how much of it people are just sort of demanding on their own. I just looked here real quick at our room and board when we were seniors. It was like $1,100. If you popped it in the inflation calculator, it's $7,300 today. Yet, I'm going to say that Northwestern, the last time I looked, I don't want you to do this. Just find out what the room and board is at Northwestern. I'm going to say it's 19 now, maybe 20, because I looked before COVID.
Now, it's I doubt if it includes maid service, too, Tom.
Well, yeah, right. but nobody sleeps on Army bunks now either. You know, so
no,
how much of it? I guess we're trying to figure out. Kevin sent that stuff around regarding which university levels were kind of in trouble. And what do you see is this, obviously the one that's having the trouble here is actually where Andrew went to school and where our buddy Eric is a tenured professor at Columbia here in Chicago. And
I can say it looks like it's just a little bit over 20,000.
Yeah, it's a number. So it's like three times what it was, what the CPI would tell you it is. And I'm going to say tuition's got to be, I'll do the tuition the same way. I can do my little calculator here. But Kevin, you go first. What do you think has happened? Where's the strain? Where's the strain the most, do you think?
Well, this kind of started with the notion, and because it became government policy, it showed up in a lot of funding models. But the notion that everybody should go to college. And I'm not talking about whether you go for enrichment to get, to get some general education. I'm talking about you should go to college, get a degree, have a college, a career that requires a college degree. And so I think we have discovered that there aren't enough jobs that match that. And, what did I mention earlier? That there's a lot of disappointment. That people are, they go to college, they do what they think they were supposed to do, only to find out that you really don't, it wasn't worth it. There's also a lot more people who are getting more involved in trades and manufacturing and, in jobs that just never required a degree. And you're starting to see a shift in emphasis there, I think, in the market in general. Now, I remember, this is a few years old, but in the state of Indiana, they projected that something like, two-thirds, maybe 70% of all jobs in the state would require some kind of advanced credential beyond high school. But by the same token, only about half of those were bachelor's degrees.
Well,
that's what you're seeing in the job market, and I think you're starting to see a substantial shift in that as well. So what does that mean? Well, one is it means very practical majors are really important, so that's part of the equation. The other thing that small liberal arts colleges are the ones that are really taking a lot of the first hits, and so that's a big factor, and I sent you that list of all the schools that have closed in the last year or so. Most of them are small liberal arts colleges, but also enrollment is down in many schools. I won't say 100% because ours isn't down, but it's been hard work getting it back up because for 2 years we sent everybody home and told them not to come to campus, which I thought was. I think was dumb. It was dumb for all colleges to do that because you taught people that whole college experience that we like to sell was not quite so important. So that was a bad lesson to teach the consumer of your service. But But to go on, what we're really saying is that we're sort of reshaping the job market in ways that don't require a bachelor's degree for a large number of people, and as a result, you're seeing enrollment decline in the colleges, and it's showing up. And it's not just the small liberal arts colleges. Those are the ones that are closing. But it's, you know, what examples did I give you? Valparaiso.
Well, our tuition...
Valparaiso is in U.S. News and World Reports, has consistently been the top regional university in the Midwest. And they're scaling back. And Xavier brought in McKinsey and Company to evaluate what they should be doing. Well, if you bring in the McKinsey consultants, guess what? You're going to get a lot of cost cuts, which means programs cut. Drake, programs cut. Everybody, you know, I mean, they're not just lopping off two or three majors. They're lopping off, you know, 20.
Well, I'll lab a couple of numbers at you. Well, Jan and I, since you're a young punk, John and my senior year, I'm going to say tuition was $3,200. If you put that into the calculator here, it should be 21.5, and it's probably 60. So it's three times over what the inflation said it should be. And you remember?
So they don't even have a good value proposition anymore.
Well, you remember? Because I guess I'm trying to economically, I'm trying to back into what, and, you know. Remember? You remember Pat Burke? Kid Pearl.
Sure.
Well, this is how politically incorrect things were in the days. He was a student union director when we were seniors, and of course he was younger. So for our entire senior year, his name was Sud, right? Hey, Sud, get over here. Anyway, I went to his wedding, and a real nice time. His wife's terrific. She went to St. Mary's, and Father was a redheaded guy. Father Schlaver was the head of the student union.
I'll take your word for it.
He's at the wedding, and he did the thing, and of course he gets a few cocktails in him, and we had his conversation. He says, you know, all of a sudden everybody's got to be in engineering or in accounting because that's where you get the jobs. He goes, I got news for you. I didn't give up my life to work for vocational school. I gave up my life to broaden people's mind and to learn a whole lot of stuff. And whatever job they got when they got out of here, they just were better human beings because of it. I'm not training somebody to be an accountant. You can go to community college and do that. That's not what I'm doing for people. I mean, when he said that, it's sort of that way today, Kevin. If it was 21 grand to go to Notre Dame, I didn't go there to become an accountant. I went there to go to Notre Dame. I mean, to learn to have a university education and everything. I mean, I
get that, but you know. Is that worth $80,000 to you?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It could be worth 80. It sure as hell isn't worth 240.
Well, yeah, 80 a year.
Yeah.
So
30.
That's a big factor in the equation.
But did your mom say, hey, Kevin, I'm ponying up $3,200 a year. You better get out. If you don't come out of here with a big A job, you're being banned from the family. She never said that. Big eight accounting firm or something.
I'm trying to think of a time she told me that I was banned from the family. Oh no, never mind. where I'm going with it is you still have to have a value proposition. Look, I teach a lot of classes, a lot of different disciplines, and I can tell you that exactly what you just mentioned about, you know, I don't want that idea that I don't want to be at a vocational school. I don't see it that way. So where I may be teaching some very specific career-related subjects, there never goes by a class where I don't have some content in there that I think is going to develop them as people.
I'm going to say that you're unique at
them,
that.
And my wording to them is very consistently, I'm trying to help you become a better fill-in-the-blank, a better IT professional. More relatable, ready for responsibility, ready to deal with different kinds of people in the workplace and different generations.
Well, you're unique with that. If you're teaching accounting, all you teach is accounting. You don't care about anything else.
That's not the way I do it.
Okay, well, John, tell Kevin, even though he's not arguing with you, tell him he's wrong and I'm right.
He's right.
Oh, God.
I mean, he's right on everything.
Yes, he is.
The
and let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, okay.
I'll sign off. Rule.
But I'm saying we've outpriced the university concept, because I think I don't want society being dumbed down. And by the way, I love the fact, Kevin, that you could be teaching somebody mechanical drawing and they're going to learn something coming out of there above mechanical drawing. I mean, I took Milton Friedman for price theory. I didn't give a crap about price theory. I wanted to be in class with Milton Friedman, knowing he talked about other stuff, and he did, because he didn't like price theory either. I mean, so I learned about economics worldwide from the guy in a class that was boring and stiff. But how many
the universities and colleges, I think, and Kevin too, I think that they're largely responsible for the kind of mess they're in. The reason why the smaller liberal arts colleges can't survive is because when it comes to recruiting students, there's no charm or excitement in going to a small town that a lot of people still have never heard of, even though the campus may be exquisite and the tradition may be very, very rich and the faculty will be first rate and the student faculty ratio is unbeatable. That doesn't work in the amenities race that the universities and colleges have become so involved in. You need comfort. You need excitement. You need things to do. You don't just go there to become a better person. You go there to have a good time. And this is why I agree that it would be great if you could produce an all-around student. But when you've spent so much money and charge students so much money to have great leisure time, this is not really part of the education process as we saw it. I mean, Notre Dame was very shabby chic when I went there. I mean, there were parts of the administration building that were condemned because they'd fallen into disrepair. Everything on campus needed major work. It had been very little construction, and most of it was pretty awful that now is to be replaced. But we didn't go there because it was a fancy physical plant, and you put up with the cockroaches and everything else. I didn't mind that. I thought that's what the college experience.
Well, that's why I stayed on the third floor. We never saw a cockroach. You guys down lower in a place.
You talked to Dave Murphy.
Where was he?
That's not pre-breakfast. We don't want to talk about this.
Yeah, but he was in the basement. He deserved them. That's where he's supposed to be.
No, I was in the first floor with him. We were right, next to the entrance on the east side of the building, above the basement, probably above the food sales room. And our battle with cockroaches this sophomore year was, something I choose not to forget.
Well, for the listeners, and again, it's a
remembered in nightmares, all right, John?
Yeah, right.
Well, let's just say this to the listeners: Notre Dame had a central power plant where they produced pretty much all their own electricity. It was a coal-fired plant, and it also produced steam for the radiators in all the dorms. And the steam pipe went down the middle of the quad. So in the dead of winter, you'd see 3 feet of snow, and then in the middle, there'd be no snow because the steam pipe was right there.
Well, snow days, Notre Dame, you can always get the class.
So were those things entered the building? If you were downstairs, let's just say the brand of cockroach, if you had a saddle, you could use it. But those boys, I never saw one on the third floor. They had a limited range up. First floor I heard about, a second floor once in a while, third floor I never saw one. Just saying. But now they don't have, is that plant even open anymore? Matter of fact, they talk about railroad. The shortest railroad in the country was a line from Notre Dame up to Niles where it met the Pennsylvania line, right? Was it the Notre Dame and Northwestern Railroad? It was 6 miles or 7 miles. That was their own little locomotive. Remember that little guy? He would go up there and he'd get a couple of coal cars.
One of the spur lines of that used to run along Niles Avenue. Now it's a nature trail, but it ran up to St. Mary's and hauled coal for their power plant.
I
could sit in the room I rented senior year, Tom, and look out the window, and the engineer would pass probably about 15 feet away from my window, and we'd wave to each other every day.
Well, the thing would, he'd scoot up his little locomotive, he'd come back with like 3 coal cars for the week.
Yeah, a little dummy thing that hauled coal.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to see these places. I mean, it's one thing for Valpo to cut back a couple of majors, Kevin, but we don't want Valpo to close. Did we forget to say?
No, we don't want Valpo to close.
No.
It's a really good school, but on the other hand, if they're going to chop out 18 majors or something like that, that's significant. And, that may be what they need to do so that they don't close. But it may just as well be a harbinger of what's coming for them. I don't think it is, by the way. I think it's a great school with a great reputation. So I think it probably will be okay. But what they do know is that they can't operate. And in a couple of cases, like, they're killing supply chain management. Good for me, by the way, because, you know, I'll get their students, or I'll get some of those students. But that was a new major for them. That, you know, they just put that in.
Well, you know,
it's out. We can't sink the effort into growing it.
Right, for the dummies of the world like me, when they cut 20 majors, how many majors do they have? I mean, how many majors do they allegedly have in a place like
that? I don't know. In many cases, you're probably looking at, you know, 50 or more. 100.
Yeah,
maybe
100.
Yeah.
Because you talk about lack of foresight. John, you might remember him. Kevin, I don't know if you did. Remember Fran Finnegan?
Oh, yeah.
Fran showed up at Notre Dame. He was a year ahead of me and Jan. So he showed up. He had this early interest in something really stupid called computers. And his freshman year, I think Notre Dame, while he was there and a computer major, they dumped the computer major while he was in it as a freshman or as a sophomore, whatever it was. And so for like a year or two, they didn't have that as a major. They figured out, well, they better bring it back. Fran was a guy who kept doing it on his own. I'd see him trudging along campus back when you had those. When did we get rid of the big cards, Kevin? Remember, we had to punch out the card, and the card went through the computer?
Those lasted into the 70s in some places.
Wow. So he was
well into the 70s in some places.
How hard was it to punch those damn things yourself? It had to be pain.
Well, you didn't punch them yourself. There was a machine that punched them. It was a key punch machine.
Yeah, you keyed it on a. Yeah.
Well, he used to do all that himself. And one of the things he did. He was a big football fanatic, but the guy was, what, 5'9", 130 pounds on a bad day? I remember he broke his ankle playing intramural football. But he got to the point where he said, we need to tie this together. How, you know, you call your buddy who's a coach in Oregon, oh, man, I got this kid at halfback, he's, like, really fast. Then you call somebody in Nevada, I got this kid at halfback, he's really fast. Well, Fran was a guy who tried to put together, like, 5 or 10 different things. Okay, how fast is he in the 40? How big is he? You know what? He got like 10 variables, and all the coaches ended up kind of using those variables so they could compare people that they never saw. Well, when Fran graduated, I think he sold that system to Hank Stram at Kansas City when he was a coach at Kansas City Chiefs, and right after they won or they were in one of the Super Bowls. I think he got like 20 or 25 grand, and then he was followed by like 5 other guys in the next couple of months. So the dude made like $125,000 for the system, and who knows? He probably kept with it forever. And this is that was so much money back in those days, and all because he did this kind of all on his own. He was a really bright kid, nice guy.
Oh yeah, super nice.
And so he was one of the first people to put scoring for athletes, Kevin. Where, okay, how fast is he? Well, he's a 4.4. Well, he's a 5.5, you know, or something like that. Where you could compare people. What's the word for that?
Is it like early version of analytics?
Yeah, it was essentially like the first version of it. Or else, how could you, if you're the head coach at Ohio State or someplace, you call two of your buddies, yeah, this kid's really fast. Well, how fast? Well, really fast. Well, what are we talking here? Is he 9.200 or is he 10.2? I mean, and Fran got some variables and put them together so you could actually somewhat compare guys. And Hank Stram was the first one to say, hey, we need that. Hank Stram was a pretty smart guy, I think. Yeah. Anyway, Kevin, thank you for hanging on.
Plus, he famously called the 64 toss power trap.
Yeah. Whatever, give that story.
You can find it on YouTube. It's a Super Bowl play call where he sends in that play because it'll work, and then they're celebrating it, and all he could keep doing was, how about that, boys? 64 nonstop power trap. It's one of those great moments in the Super Bowl.
Oh, God. Was this the first time they won?
Yeah, back in, like, Super Bowl IV.
Well, they were in Super Bowl II and lost to the Packers. And then they won. Then Baltimore was the first American team to win. That was the third year, right?
Not Baltimore, the Jets.
That's right, the Jets. When I said Baltimore, I meant...
they beat Baltimore.
Yeah. Because John Shula was in... Well, he was the coach of Baltimore. That's right.
Yeah.
And what did Johnny United say? If they'd put you in halftime, would you have won? And he said, I wouldn't have needed that much time. He was not a Shula fan. He was not a Shula fan because Shula wouldn't let him call the plays. And Johnny Unitas always called the plays. Anyway. Well, Kevin, thank you. We'll switch subjects with Jan. We'll stay on this one a little bit, Jan. Is it? I mean, I keep looking at this as a cost accountant sort of dude, which I was. Is overhead choking us all? It's choking the medical industry. Is it choking the universities too?
Well, if you factor in all of the construction that universities feel they need to be, ahead of as a recruitment tool and just as a way to compete in some kind of prestige market. Yeah, the overhead for that stuff is fantastically high and getting higher all the time.
Isn't that stuff at these, I won't say the word elite, I just did. I was under the impression that Notre Dame and Northwestern and those kinds of places, whenever they build something, it's donated essentially off the current balance sheet and income statement. That the soccer field that Notre Dame builds, it's because Andrew's grandpa gave him the money for.
Well, they've got the naming rights, and they've got family contributions, and program development that's tailored to the particular donor. So sure, a lot of it could be put on another set of books, but it does help. When it comes to maintenance and kind of acquiring land when you need it, if you've run out of space to build on it, certainly Notre Dame is an example of that.
Well, they ended up taking over. They stole the street or bought the street from the city.
Yeah. I don't think they can tack that on to any kind of family donor. I think they're going to have to do that and then allow somebody to use that land for a purpose that they specify and monitor, and pretty much control, and maybe actually provide a lot of the financial support for it, but acquiring the land and the infrastructure and everything else, I think, is on a university.
Well, but they you wonder what kind of deal that was for those that we're talking about one place, but it's also, I'm sure it's happening all over the place. There was a road that went by Notre Dame near the stadium, and all of a sudden they couldn't really expand any more that way, and decided, okay, we're going to. There was a what was the school? It was the school for challenged kids. Was across the street, right? So
yeah.
They took that school and some other thing and basically got a lot of that land, moved the road, 1,000 yards south, and basically took the land where the road was. It's now like you can see pieces of the road where you can kind of drive through one of the parking lots, but it also caused an area there to have all kinds of restaurants and hotels and so forth that didn't before. So, it definitely upped the tax piece for South Bend, because that's South Bend, that's not Notre Dame. So I'm wondering if they almost didn't get some kind of a square deal on it. I mean, they probably had to pay for the new road to be put in, but I bet they got a pretty nice deal on that, Jan. I don't know how much they paid.
Well, South Bend certainly benefited from it.
Yeah.
But just to take South Bend as an example, Tom, it's a city. From what I've seen of it in the last, since I graduated, I've been back there periodically over the years. It's beyond struggling at this point. Even having Notre Dame, it kind of the prime point in its existence as an institution that's much better regarded than it was when we went there. Much harder to get into, much more expensive. But South Bend as a city is flopped. It hasn't brought any kind of new prosperity or cachet to being a resident of South Bend. I think the city population is almost a third lower than what it was when we went there.
Well, they had Studebaker and they had Bendix.
Studebaker was gone when we went there.
But recently gone.
Yeah.
A couple years.
Right, within the last 7 years or so. And the city was still reeling from it.
But Bendix was huge at the time, and I don't know what's left there at the Bendix plant. I mean, I don't know if they're even open, but what you end up seeing, Jan and Kevin, if you looked at the area, and this is kind of what's happening, this is what I'm really concerned about with Chicago. I mean, I'm really concerned about it, is if you look at the, throw a 200-mile ring around South Bend, you'll see incredible development, which is what Kevin is teaching to. because you're right on the Indiana Toll Road. You're right on close to I-65. You're equidistant, really, between Chicago and Detroit and Indianapolis and maybe even Columbus. I mean, so you've got places. Cleveland, you're not that far away. So it's a distribution heaven. But now, very little of that is actually in South Bend proper. South Bend proper is, you know, parts of it is like Gary, basically, right? I mean, so the development, and I think what's happened here in Chicago is very similar. I mean, Chicago was the rail capital of the world. Still railroad lines all over the place. Yet, the new Burlington, is it the Burlington line, is out in Joliet. And you'll see massive distribution systems around Chicago. And yet, everybody avoids, it's not like, and this is what sort of has to happen, John, with the some combination of education, people, capital, human capital, education, transportation. Somehow, somebody has got to put two or three places on the south and west side that employ for a reasonable amount, you know, 500 people or 1,000 people. Because all of a sudden now, you got to have places for them to go to drink after, have breakfast before. All of a sudden, that becomes a community. If you don't have that, I don't think our politicians have any concept of how much losing a place like that. I mean, losing Pullman, for instance. Now you've got a Walmart where Pullman used to be. So instead of 500 people making a serious wage, you've got a Walmart. Well, duh. We're not even on the same playing field with what that does to you, right? I mean, I don't think our guys even know. Or, you know, maybe they do.
And Chicago, you know, as a prime example of this, I mean, yes, the steel mills were bad for the environment, and yes, you know, coal-fired plants, you know, choked a lot of people, but the city grew until 1950, you know, at a fantastic rate that, you know, defied any previous city's growth in world history. And of course, you never know that looking at Chicago now, because it doesn't look all that hot. It doesn't look that special anymore, really. I mean, the downtown is beautiful and everything else, but the overwhelming picture of it is the city has seen better days, and maybe it's already seen its best days, which has got a lot of people demoralized. But
Kevin tweets in that you're wrong. South Bend is actually doing pretty well in some high-tech stuff in the last few years. They're doing some, but it's been a 50-year.
I overspoke. You know, I didn't mean that it was not that there was, but as a city, I mean, it's declining. Population's declining. It's becoming, you know, nothing like it was, I don't think. And it's just a much sleepier, less interesting place than I recall it was when I went to school there.
Well, John, we come back. Let's talk a little bit. Well, we'll talk a little about the market and so forth, but let's talk a little bit about the manufacturing hubs and so forth, and why people think you don't need them anymore. When, man, oh man, I look at the rest of the world. S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 138. We come back with the traffic, weather, sports, and then we'll talk to John.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice.
At PTI, we have always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it is time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTIsecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTIsecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Al. Andrew on the board, Mr. John Flanagan with us. S&P futures up 16, NASDAQ futures up 139. Everybody loves the Tesla coming out with cheaper cars a year from now or more. Meanwhile, I got them up to damn near 100 times earnings. I don't know. I mean, it is whatever. Everybody loves it this morning, though. It's up $16, almost 2%. I'm sorry. No, it's up 4. Where am I at here? These are all up. We're up $16. That's almost 11%. I've got Meta up $14, that's 3%, and NVIDIA up $15, 2%. So we're loving the Magnificent Seven here, except Apple's down a dime and Google's down 8 cents. The rest of them to the moon, Alice. Dow futures are actually minus 3. And Boeing up $6 as they came out and gave some mumbo-jumbo. But and IBM is up 2, and Microsoft's up 3.5. So I'm not seeing... Well, we got Amgen down 369, and we've got... Goldman Sachs down $1.72, so the Dow is kind of flat with the earnings stocks flipping around there. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 42, up 0.2%, FTSE up 45.6%, CAC around up 38.5%. So positive momentum is holding over there as well as here, at least so far. Nikkei up, wow, up 907, 2.4. Hang Seng up 372, 2.2, back over 17,201, and the Shanghai actually kind of went with it today, up 22.8%. So we're Australian inflation slowed for the fifth straight quarter, so everybody's celebrating over in the other side of the Pacific. Yesterday, Dow was up 263, S&P up 59, NASDAQ up 245. So we've erased the big sell-off on Friday for sure, I think. Bonds, 10-year up 5 basis points, 4.65. Still troubling. Bund up 7 basis points, 2.58. Japan up 1, I'm going to say 0.9 for the first time in a long, long time. Oil down 34 cents, 83.02. Brent down 24 cents, 88.18. Oil market has calmed down considerably after last weekend's, I'll say, limited strike by Israel. It seemed to be less than people thought, and maybe the feeling is that that's kind of it between them and Iran for a while. Let's hope that's true. Gold, which has been getting hammered, down another $14 today, 23.28. Silver down 20 cents, 27.15. Don't need any of this stuff now. The world is a great place. I don't know if I buy that one. Copper rubber is up 4 cents, 4.47. They've been steadily climbing there. Euro, 106.90. So dollar has remained strong here. British pound, 124.43. We got Bitcoin up 76 bucks, 66.613. A lot of mumbo-jumbo there. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Looks cloudy to me.
Yeah, it's going to stay like that for the whole day, it looks like. It is 7:37 here in Chicago on Wednesday, April 24th. Starting off a little bit of sports, you got some baseball. White Sox lost to the Twins 6-5. Cubs won over the Astros 7-2. And the Diamondbacks won over the Cardinals 14-1. Again, that Chicago weather, it is going to be partly cloudy, well, mostly cloudy throughout the full day. We're going to be at around 40 degrees and a high of 43, and that's going to hit around 2 p.m., so not much change throughout the whole day. But over in Phoenix, they got things a lot more clear. They are currently at 65 degrees, clear skies. They're going to have a high of 92 today, and that's going to hit around 3 p.m. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, there are no major accidents to report. If you're coming in on the Dan Ryan, traffic seems to be a little heavier than usual, especially around about 47th Street. And if you're on the outbound, look out for the Eisenhower, a little bit on the Kennedy. Things are building up a little bit about halfway on your way out. So that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
The John, a couple things here, just as the economic moves, as I keep talking about the stock market, and how with this 10-year rate creeping up here, it's something you just have to be concerned about. I mean, I got the TNX now at 4.64. It's a 10-year. TYX is 4.77. And you value your stocks, your future income. I mean, you know, basically Tesla doesn't make any money. It makes a little bit. They used to make a lot of dough because they had all those credits from other companies. I think those are kind of falling by the wayside. So now they're not making much on their own. Now, do you really want to pay? And the answer today is yes, because people are buying it. Do you really want to pay, you know, $160 for something that makes $1.60 a year? Let's put it this way. If interest rates are 15%, the answer is no. If they're 1.5%, you know, you can wait, okay, because you got no other place to put it. You got nowhere else to go. Somewhere in here, people are going to, I think, are going to start looking at these rates and saying, I got to actually look and see what these guys are doing for me before I commit. Are they really going to be making X number of dollars 2 years from now or 3 years from now? And then, but on the side of that, we have allegedly a Fed that comes out every week and talking about in time they're going to come back to this inflation level of 2%. Well, I don't know what time they're talking about. You know, it's like one of the greatest lines from my buddy John Najarian, Dr. J. John, we're at this show out in Vegas. And every time I went to a show, there was this guy. What the hell was his name? I'll think of it. But Joe Gandolfo. And Joe is one of these guys that was an advisor. And for $1,000, he would be your advisor, like, for forever. You know, what life insurance should you buy? What this and that and the other thing? And people used to like that. If somebody call, well, of course, he'd give you some company he was getting a kickback from or whatever. A piece of, shall we say. Kickback, such a bad word. But so Chad says to him, I'm standing right there. He says, so Joe, what's the deal? It's $1,000. He had a great voice, too. He had a voice just like John Carradine, Kung Fu's father. Bro, it's $1,000.
The fulcral, yes. The fulcral voice.
$1,000 for life. What do you think John says to him? Whose life, Joe? You don't look so hot. So from that day on, every time somebody says it's a lifetime guarantee, I go, whose life? I mean, they look at me like I got anyway, just being an idiot. But our money supply, since, of course, we get everything a month late now, we do, but I'm sure the member firms and all the other people that are in the know get it like weekly like we used to get it. But the we's don't deserve it anymore, right? Anyway, money supply was actually up in March from $20,748,000 to $20,841,000. So let's say up $100 billion. And I've got it pretty much the exact same number as March of 2023. A little lower. It's $100 million lower. After it was up 40% in 18 months to 2 years. Guys, let me just help you. You're not fighting it very hard. You're hoping it goes down. You're trying to talk it down. But you're not fighting it very hard. You're not fighting it at all. I'm just saying that. So I think the market is got two things going for it. We still have money percolating through the system. So the market is probably destined to go higher. Yet these 10-year rates, if they keep going up, because people now are believing that inflation's not coming down, you have a real war there. Now, because of people's experience in the last, certainly since 2008, the market always comes back. You always buy the dip. The experience is that people feel that we're going to continue to go up. And by the way, we probably will. Yet just be careful, because if these rates keep going, I know a lot of people, Dan will talk about it tomorrow some, a lot of people are saying, they're piling out a little bit and saying, well, you know, if I can get 5.5 instead of being 100% in the market, I'm not going to be, you know, 30% in the market and the rest in fixed income, but guess what? I'm gonna be 80% in the market and 20. You're starting to see a little dribble. I know here at PTI, every Monday, we're going to get auctions for people in the Treasury. I'm not saying those people are right or whatever. Just kind of be careful here, because there is two sides to this coin here. Where in 2010, the government pouring money in, there was only one side to the coin, right? It was just going up. Anyway, so that's kind of where that all. What do you make of that, John? The idea that every day they say they're fighting us and they're not.
Well, what would fighting it look like?
You went up. If you wanted to attack, not only there's two issues here, and I keep saying this, and I don't know if I ever get any traction. There's two issues. All you hear about is the inflation rate. And the inflation rate is the is the rate of price increases now. It's the second derivative of the curve. It's the rate of increase or the rate of decrease, which would be deflation. But there's also, because of what happened all of a sudden, in other words, you could double the money supply, okay, and all of a sudden in the next 6 months, everything would double, okay? If everybody walked into the Federal Reserve and you gave them a Washington and you walked out with a Jefferson, Jefferson being a $2 bill, Washington $1 bill, all of a sudden everybody would adjust. If I owed you 20 bucks, I'd now owe you 40, right? It'd be like a stock split. But we don't do that. We creep it in so some people benefit, some people don't. But let's not talk about that. So the next day, we say, okay, we're not going to increase the money supply at all for the next 5 years. Well, the rate of inflation of increase from that day would be zero. But now we have a price level problem. The price levels are double what they were. Think of it, for instance, John, if I'll give another example. You know, you live in Podunk, Idaho, right? And all of a sudden, one day, they say to park your car in front of your house, it's going to cost you $1,000. And you go, what? Okay, so now it's $1,000 that you didn't count on. So there's a price level there, so you're cutting back on all the other stuff to pay for the $1,000. But and it wasn't even in the inflation calculator to start with, so it's not even counted, okay? But now all of a sudden the next 5 years it stays $1,000. Well, now it's in the calculator and it's not going up. So now it actually makes it look like there's less inflation than there is if other stuff's going up. So we have a price level problem here. We have a huge part of the population that, hey, the car's gone up from 30,000 to 55, the mean car, the median car, or 52, whatever the hell it is, I can't pay 52. Okay, but that's okay, Joe. It's not going up from 52. So what? I can't pay 52. Unless I get a 40% raise in my salary, which, oh, by the way, now I'm in a different tax bracket, so it's not really 40. Say I need a 50% tax increase to break even, you're not getting it. So we have a price level problem, which has nothing to do with the inflation problem. And am I being clear or am I being fuzzy as usual?
Right, and the only cure to that, Tom, is catastrophic deflation, which
I'm not even sure that I would say. But I would say what we probably could do or should do is, since we have money still coming in because it was so much it isn't even in the system yet, we should drain 3 or 4 or 5% out of the system, and hope that over the next few years wages slowly catch up. That would be my strategy, and maybe the Fed actually is secretly doing that. But I think you got to drain it a little bit. You can't let it sneaky creep up again. You're not going to drain it 40%. You're right. We're talking about 1933. You can't do that. Okay, because
nobody will let that happen. But traditionally, it did happen. You didn't have government intervention. You didn't have Federal Reserve wonks or central banks generally trying to stave off deflation like that. And when it happened, of course, tremendous suffering.
But you also have to get the money. Give you a instance. I mean, all I do is tout the fact that I was fortunate enough to have Milton Friedman for class and go, Milton Friedman was wrong in a lot of areas that I found as I've aged. If you were to ask him or any monetarist flat out, hey, probably even Hal, because Hal doesn't think he's a monetarist, but a libertarian guy is pretty much a monetarist. I don't know if he'd agree with that. But so if you were to say, what caused the Great Depression? None of those guys would say the crash of 29. And they'd probably be right. They would say that over the next 2 or 3 years, the government allowed, especially with the bank was the bank panic, it was 31 or 32, some it wasn't 29, was it 32?
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. They would say that the federal government allowed the money supply to decrease by 22 to 30% over a six-month period, and that threw us into the Depression. Now, they are correct on that. I will absolutely say they're correct on that. However, it didn't hurt people the same, John. If Grandma Flanagan had $2,000 in a bank that she saved her whole life for, with Grandpa Flanagan, and she went to the bank, and the bank slammed her in the nose and said, "You're not getting your money out." Okay, so that $1,500 comes out of the system, comes out of the money supply. It's gone, right? Because the bank's under it. It's just gone. It's not like it's anywhere. Not anybody got it, right? The loans were under, and they don't have it. And it's gone. So it disappeared from the system. So when Milton Friedman and those guys say the problem was we let the money supply, somebody let the money supply drop 22%, the hint is if somehow the Federal Reserve at the time would have somehow pumped the same amount of money into the system, which I don't even think they had the ability to do that back then. I'm sure they didn't have all the government bonds out there that they could go buy and that kind of crap. They could have bought assets, I guess. My point, John, is if they didn't find Grandma Flanagan with some sort of a retroactive SIPC or something and say, everybody who lost their savings in this 5,000 banks that went under, we're going to give everybody a check for a third of it or 40% of it or something. If you didn't find the individual people, the money you poured into the system would be like the money you poured in during COVID. It's going to find the greedy, not the greedy hands, but it's going to find some hands, not Grandma Flanagan. You might have made it worse for her because now all of a sudden the prices are going up and she doesn't have any money. So,
right, but, you know, that was the plan with the COVID money, Tom.
Clearly. Yeah. But, I mean, somewhere along the line, you have to find, I mean, with the inflation going up, okay, as much as it has, everybody, I don't care who you are, even if you disagree with my economics at all, you're going to say that some people have benefited and some people haven't. Some people have pricing power, some people don't. PTI has no pricing power. We're competitive. I mean, we didn't charge $2 a contract in 2020 and are charging $5 now like some firms. I mean, we can't do that. So we're not a winner on this. We're probably a loser because our rent's up and everything else. Okay, our business is up, but still, that we worked for, and so it's not like if you went the other way, like you suggested, not suggested, but you said what we'd actually would have to do. I'm going to say you're going to be the same way. The people who got hurt on the way up are going to get hurt even more on the way down. It won't be even either, will it? So you don't want to do that.
But look at what we are doing, Tom. This is just making the inevitable crash more painful to consider, and making it longer to recover from. So it isn't like we're fixing anything with, you know, throwing, you know, $100 billion overseas for arms, you know, putting it in the pockets of God knows whom.
Yeah.
Well, this is only going to make it a worse, you know, reckoning when things really.
Can I? I don't know if I ever told you. You've got a few minutes. This is kind of a crazy story, but this is kind of the stupid stuff I do. One of my clients, good guy, said to me, he's got a friend, and he's got one of these, I might have told you this right over a beer, but he's got all these German bearer bonds of the 1930s, right? And somehow or another, these things were supposedly gold-backed, and the banks are still there, and the companies are still there, and yet he can't get a price for them. So, you know, it's not like I don't have other stuff to do, managing money from people. But I said, hey, this is kind of interesting. So I jump online and I immerse myself in the world of people with these bearer bonds that you can't get, that nobody will pay for. A lot of countries have them. Mexico has bearer bonds that, you know, bearer bonds means you bring them in, they're supposed to give you the money, right? They have bearer bonds from like, who was the French guy? Maximilian. They have bearer bonds from his rent.
And
they've got bearer bonds from Santa Ana. These were issued by the Mexican government. But, of course, they get a new government, and they say, screw those bonds. I mean, we don't do that here. At least we haven't yet. Oh, no, those were Trump's bonds. They're no good. Or those were Bush's bonds or Obama's bonds.
Yeah, you missed your coupon date on those.
Yeah, you missed your coupon date. We didn't like Truman. Those are no good, even though they're 30 years. We don't do that here yet, anyway. So the German ones were the most crazy because after World War One, the Germans are paying these reparations that they can't afford, and then the French and the British are paying loans back to us which they couldn't afford, right? So our government allowed the Germans to come over and sell these bonds in this country. They actually had some kind of number, and they weren't a CUSIP number yet because they weren't invented, but they were sold here. So people here are buying these damn things. The money's going to Germany.
Coming back to us, then.
Yeah. Coming back to us, to the government. Talk about a circle, whatever.
Well, you know, that shows, Tom. I mean, it was a very unpopular thing to have these war debts going unpaid.
Yeah.
And this was public relations stuff, maybe. But the idea was, we don't really care where the investors come from as long as we get the return on what we're owed.
Well, so the bottom line
is from ourselves here.
But the more I get involved, because you started this by asking about where his money going, the more I got involved in this, people were saying that if you had these bonds that were, there's all this. I got into this. I won't say it was the dark web because I wouldn't know anything about the dark web. That's a Kevin question. There's this subterranean world that, of all these people that are passing stuff like this around and getting collateral for these projects. It's almost like it's another money world, and I barely dabbled at the top of it. And there's all these people that have these bonds, and some people will like take them as collateral over some kind of a loan, even though the bond is not worth it. It's really screwed up, right? So. But I also talked to some people that were doing a lot of these things worldwide. You know, the Bill Gateses of the world and so forth. And, you know, there are people who actually have a lot of money and are trying to put, like, a water treatment plant in Sudan or some damn place or someplace in Africa or someplace where they need it. And these guys were telling me, because, you know, people talk to me. I mean, I don't know, I guess I have that gift of gab, I guess you want to call it. So they're talking to me and said, you know, if you just send money to like or supplies to Sudan or whatever the hell, pick a place, you're going to lose 90% of your crap to wealth and all the other kind of stuff, or to theft and all the other kind of stuff. If you're big enough like Bill Gates, they actually have boots on the ground and say, this is, we're actually going to build a thing and we're going to send people over like to build it, then you might actually get 50 to 55, possibly 60% of your money going to the project rather than paying people off or paying people not to rob it from you. And I'm sitting there going, wow. I mean, I guess that's kind of what, but we get all the way around to the, before we went to break, I said, you know, we think we don't need these manufacturing things. It's mundane. Yet, Jan, this is not table talk, but allegedly 400 million people every day in India poop outside. Do we think the world doesn't need toilets? I mean, I think they do. Don't, I mean, tell me how many water heaters, if we ever turned Yemen or Sudan around, how many hot water heaters, how many air conditioners would the place need? It's not like everybody's house looks like, you know, yours or mine, which maybe aren't the best, but at least we got an air conditioner, we got a toilet. I mean, the whole world is totally undersupplied on all this stuff. I mean, you would think that there would be a massive market worldwide. We should have, you know, 15 plants in Chicago making toilets and water heaters, for God's sake, not to mention sinks and everything else. I mean, it's not like there's not a demand for it. Is it there? I mean, the whole world needs... I mean, how many people have up-to-date water heaters in Venezuela, for God's sake? Nobody. I mean, is anybody? I mean, I'm saying that this idea...
How many people in Chicago do
that? Yeah, how many people in Chicago don't? I mean, you look around and you say...
Well,
there's,
you know, yes, you could... there's lots of appetite for these things, and it would be, you know, a growth industry to supply these amenities for people who never had them, don't know what they are, and would certainly benefit from them. But then what? You know, once these people, you know, understand the luxuries of indoor plumbing, how are you going to give them an affordable house to have the plumbing in? I mean, what are they going to do when it comes to, you know, passing
but,
out whatever
but,
wealth?
But the whole, don't we think, though, Jan, that income creates income? That if all of a sudden, if somebody... I'm not saying people should be doing this without a job, but if everybody in Chicago, and you go anywhere. I went to see the Cubs play in Toronto. And I drove through Buffalo, and I'm looking around, and Buffalo's an older city than Chicago. And I just, most of the homes are frame. I'm going to say that if all of a sudden people in Buffalo, if there was some kind of a plant there that, you know, made something for, you know, whatever, some place in Africa that has gold or that can afford to pay for it. All of a sudden now, if those people in Buffalo start making 25, 30, 40 bucks an hour or whatever, what's 40 bucks, 80 grand a year? Every one of those houses looked to me like they could have used a roof. They probably need some insulation. They all look like they needed some new window. It's not like we, and everybody talks about energy conservation and, you know, the guy next door, you know, running his lawnmower with gas and how, what a big bleep he is. I'm going to say if we insulated houses or even these buildings downtown and stuff, we could conserve more energy doing that than ever you can bitching at your neighbor on his lawnmower. We're not even close.
And they have them all heated with natural gas, too.
Well, I read this thing, and I don't think they ever did it, Sears Tower, Willis Tower, a total redo of the building. And when the building was put up, and I don't know if they've done some of this, was all single-pane windows. And this guy, or this firm, and it could have been a lady, we got a dash here in a second, put together a plan where they were going to put double pane windows, that the kind that the sun hits them, it doesn't let as much sun in, that kind of thing, so you don't. And then every one of the levels, because the thing has all these different levels, they were going to put seven or eight of these, the windmills that look like a globe and spin, not the kind with the, you know, the Dutch one. And they were going to put like grass there or something so that the roof gets cooled. They were talking about saving enough energy for like 1,000 houses, 2,000. It's incredible the energy loss in a building that size. It was a number I couldn't even calculate. Now, isn't that better than bitching at every neighbor with a gas lawnmower? You would think.
Well, of course. But, Tommy, you know, the drive now is not towards making things or you know, training people to make them or giving people enough earning power to buy these things, but it's about extinguishing or exterminating people. The whole AI move is about, you know, finally realizing how few people we need to have the kind of planet that people at the top want and expect.
But, Chan, we need people working more than we ever have. The world needs us.
Of course, Tom. But you can't find anybody in Washington saying that. Believe me.
But why? Where do we get these people, Jen? Do they not have their eyes open?
Well, we get them because everybody in the world has to deal with them, and they've been infiltrating every government since God knows when to push this ridiculous message that people are not only expendable, but they're completely unnecessary, and they deserve to be put out of existence.
Yeah, I just hold this whole thing. I don't. Plus, it's against any kind of economic sense, which normally doesn't last very long. When I say last very long, it can last.
Let's leave morality out of it. You can't even bring that topic up.
Oh, yeah, everybody's a moral relative. I mean, speaking of which, I mean, we got a dash, but I have a quick question for you, even though they're going to unveil this bear thing today. Okay, they're supposed to be, and Lou used to always accuse Mitty Weber of being a moral relativist. Now, we're going to unveil this thing on the lakefront. We still have, I think, whoever the hell we is, have a policy of not building anything on the lakefront. And oh, by the way, Soldier Field is a landmark. So this thing is going to be in the Soldier Field parking lot, followed by the demolition of Soldier Field. Who gets to do that? this mayor can do whatever the hell he damn well please, or the Bears. Nothing applies to a sports team. Who gets to do that? You and I couldn't go. Can't put a hamburger stand on a lake.
Well, who would consider demolishing Soldier Field when renovation isn't even paid for?
Well, it's, oh God. Well, John, we will talk on Monday, if not before.
Yep.
And I don't know how many people are around tonight, but give me a buzz if you feel like coming by.
I just want to put in a word too. I really miss Russell Rhodes, Tom, and I feel inadequate to fill his shoes in this time slot.
When do you think we should tell the story, or should we?
Well, I think Russell can decide if we do.
Yeah.
I just want to say how I miss him.
I know it. It's a huge hole. It's a huge hole. Not because you guys aren't good. You are, but Russell's special. And I tell you what, we missed the hell out of him. I'm going to ask Lou if I can tell the story. Anyway, and I probably should ask Russell. But anywho, it's a bad story. S&P futures now only up 3. NASDAQ futures up 90. Back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
That's all, folks.